Central one Vargas. Central, go ahead. I'm on scene at 108 South 17th. We've got light smoke showing from a single-story commercial building. Working fire, make it a regular alarm. Engine one upon arrival. Let's see if we can get in. Let's see if there's an FPC in the back before we do anything here. That's right. I'll be establishing 17th Street command.
Not enough to fill me up. I need more than just words to say. I need everything this life can give me. Hey, cause sometimes it's not enough. Ow! Come on, baby. Well, hey everybody, welcome back to Justifiably Proud Productions. I'm your humble host, Jim Farrell. And it's good to be back. It's good to be back in the studio. I've been away for a little bit, just staying busy and keeping up with everything. And I got Dolly here, and she apparently she needs some attention. Dolly, you want to say hi to our listeners? You want to say hi? Hey, you got to ask me nicely. She's really excited to be here today, too. Anyway, it's good to be back in the studio, and welcome to our second episode of Season 2, entitled Mr. Wheat and Riding the Seat. I don't know if you've heard or not, but we've had over 1,000 people download the podcast and check it out, and I really appreciate it, and I'm thankful to everybody who continues to listen. Something that... I particularly enjoy, and I hope you enjoy it too. It's nice to get in here and talk about just random stuff and kind of get out of your head for a little bit. So thank you for that. I've also, in the last month, have celebrated 21 years of marriage. So I'm really excited about that. We took the family on a little getaway and celebrated that anniversary. So other than that, just preparing for college graduation and working and doing what I do. So thanks everybody for checking in back in with us. I hope you enjoy this episode. I've been thinking about it and daydreaming about it for a long time. And without further ado, let's get into it with What's the Word.
Give me a What's the Word?
What's the Word, man?
All right. So, little bit about me. I was born with this wonderful gift, sometimes not so wonderful, but I have a wonderful memory. And I remember, people tell me sometimes that I remember stuff that people would just rather forget. You know, I'm one of those type of people. of course, I can't remember everything, but I have a long, long memory. And sometimes people are impressed with how far back I can go and think about stuff. And so I was recently on a trip for the fire department. We went up north for a planning conference, and I was explaining to a coworker on the trip up there, you know, we had about a 7-hour drive, and I was explaining about Saturday Night Live. He was born in 82. I was born in 76. And I was just explaining to him how big a fan I was of Saturday Night Live. And I went through the whole deal about how a lot of people came over from Chicago. I think it's called Second City TV, where a lot of those performers get their start. And we talked about it. He didn't know that Wayne's World came from there. He didn't know that there was a couple other spinoffs that came from Saturday Night Live. But my oldest memory of Saturday Night Live goes back to, March 12th of 1983. So back, this was back when I was growing up in South County in South St. Louis. And my folks, the neighbors were all really good and real tight. And they got along really good. And they would play cards on the weekends and stuff in the backyards. I mean, we had nice, there was many times in the Midwest where we had really nice weather where you could sit out on your deck and play cards at night or board games or whatever. Trivial Pursuit was the big thing back then, all that kind of jazz. But so just being the way it was back then, I was left to sleep on the couch at home in front of the TV while mom and dad went to the next door neighbors and played cards. And this is the way I remember it. My folks may remember it a totally different way, but this is the way I remember it. So on March 12th, 1983, you got to understand that I'm 7 years old and there's been a lot of, well, there was a lot of assassination attempts on people in the early 80s, you know. Well, of course, John Lennon was killed. President Reagan was attempted assassination. The JFK thing was still really talked about. Anyway, so as a kid, I'm thinking we had cable already. But as a child, so you see on the news over and over, you know, as an example, President Reagan. If anybody's ever seen the footage of his attempted assassination, it's ingrained in your head, right? You remember it. He's walking out to a limo and his guards are around him and they start shooting and somebody jumps in and takes care of him and they whisk him off to the hospital. So, I mean, I guess I was old enough at the time to notice that stuff was important and it was newsworthy because that's what we would see on the news from time to time. I mean, this wasn't happening all the time, but between Lennon and Reagan, I'm setting up the story here on how this played out. But anyway, so I remember waking up on the couch. We had a split level home, which means like part of that, you'd walk in the house and there were steps going downstairs to a lower room and then there were steps going upstairs to the bedroom. But anyway, I was downstairs in the lower room, our family room. And I woke up, I don't know what time it was, but I woke up after Saturday Night Live had started to this news report coming across the airwaves that Buckwheat was dead. And they began... So there's laughter going on here, but I'm looking at it like this is a real news report, right? Whoever Buckwheat is, he's been shot and he's been killed, and they start showing footage, right? So the footage, if you ever watch it, it's similar to the way Reagan was, his attempted assassination was. They got Buckwheat's being escorted out to a car. He's got all this Secret Service or bodyguards around him. And somebody yells out, "Hey, Mr. Wheat, yes." And then boom, 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 right? So they shoot him. So I wake up to this news report, and it's Joe Piscopo, and he's playing Ted Koppel. And I don't know who any of these people are, but I'm like, oh, my God. Like, somebody's been – there's been another attempted assassination on this person, Buckwheat. And the thing about it was I'm looking around for my folks, and I don't know where they are. You know, but I know I need to tell somebody that, hey, there's some major stuff going on right now and somebody needs to know. Well, in reviewing this on YouTube, and most recently I'm checking out classic rock culture, ultimateclassicrock.com is where I found a lot of this stuff. The episode went on. It wasn't just one skit. It went on throughout the entire night. So every few minutes they were breaking in that Buckwheat had been shot. And that they found his shooter, and his shooter was John David Stance, who was also Eddie Murphy, right? And when I looked at it further, what they did was they incorporated into this skit the President Reagan issue, the Kennedy issue, because John David Stance gets assassinated when they're taking him from his hearing back to prison. And then when they asked John David Stance, I think that's what they call him, why did you do it? And he said, my dog told me to do it. He said he was the Antichrist, you know, which was, of course, referring to the son of Sam. issue, the murders, or whatever that was. So anyway, so throughout this next 30 minutes, I'm watching this, all this stuff unfold, and it's very overdramatic and all that. And so I'm reading now, and I'm learning that this was all on purpose to make it an overdramatic, because the news was always sensationalizing stuff. But anyway, so I remember running next door to the neighbors to tell mom and dad that buckwheat had been shot, you know? And so if you get a chance, check out classicrockculture.com or check out YouTube. I like to watch a lot of stuff on YouTube and some of those other social media channels. There's a lot of, I get most of my news from there, from people who are very sincere, and it really gives me an opportunity to make objective opinions about stuff. But anyway, I'm going to read a little bit from it about this whole buckwheat thing from Classic Rock, ultraclassicrock.com. On March 12, 1983, Saturday Night Live made the surprising decision to kill off one of its most popular characters, Eddie Murphy's Buckwheat. This grown-up version of the R-Gang character made his debut in 1981. During the season 7 episode, Buckwheat, with his noticeable speech impediment, performed several classic songs for a compilation album. Murphy's delivery of tunes like the Commodores' Three Times a Lady, here titled Fee Tynes a Matey, had viewers rolling with laughter. I have a very specific memory of typing this first Buckwheat sketch and almost falling off in my chair because it was so funny. Production assistant Robin Schleen recalled in the book Live from New York, The Complete Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live. Having been at the show and knowing what it took to have a great character and a great big and get a big response, I remember thinking they nailed it. This is going to be huge. Let me see here. Buckwheat quickly became the most popular character on SNL. Public demand brought the frizzy-haired character back on multiple occasions as the show's writers searched for new ways to place Buckwheat in sketches. Eventually, his popularity became too much for Murphy to deal with. The comedian, leery of seen as a one-trick pony, was determined to have leave Buckwheat behind. In January 1983, Murphy approached SNL producer Dick Ebersol and expressed his frustration. He said, "I want to kill Buckwheat. I can't stand it anymore," and that's in quotes. Ebersol recalled the comedian saying, "Everywhere I go, people say, do Buckwheat, do this, do that. I want to kill him." Understanding the situation, not wanting to upset his show's breakout star, Ebersol agreed to kill Buckwheat. So there you have it, folks. If you get a chance, check it out. There's a whole bunch of different skits about Buckwheat. One of them's called Watch Buckwheat by the Farm on SNL. And if you've seen, of course, the footage of the attempted assassination on President Reagan, you can tell how it's very similar. The Secret Service jumps in and all that kind of stuff. Or Buckwheat's bodyguards jump in to protect him. And I thought it was funny to be a little kid and wake up thinking that something's happening and I need to tell somebody, because the news keeps telling me that this terrible tragedy has happened. And I don't remember what my folks said. They probably said, go back to bed when I got over there to tell them. But it was just kind of funny. So to wrap that up, it says, in the shadow of such real-life tragic events as the assassination of John Lennon in 1980, as well as attempts on the lives of President Ronald Reagan in 81 and Pope John Paul II in 1981, the SNL Buckwheat killing was a harsh reflection of modern society. Factor the advancements in television coverage at the time CNN, the world's first 24-hour news network, had launched in 1980, and the sketch took an even deeper meaning. They purposely, like I said here, it says they purposely over-exaggerated and over-sensationalized the deal when they produced this sketch. But if you get a chance, go back and watch it. I think you'll find it funny. When they're asking the assassin who kills Buckwheat, "Did you kill Buckwheat?" He goes, "Sure." Like, it's just really funny. You got to check it out. All right, so that wraps up this week's What's the Word? I wanted to take a moment and talk I've been wanting to talk about this for a while. It's a little bit kind of similar to the apparatus anatomy sketch or this video we did, the podcast we did on apparatus anatomy. And, you know, going throughout the career and having different, being in different departments, there's been different names for this part of the apparatus. I'm talking about where the officer sits in the truck. It's been known as the officer's seat, the captain's chair, lieutenant's seat. In Missouri, we simply called it the seat. You were riding the seat, right? So the seat is where the commander of the, for the way it's set up mostly, from what I've seen, having spent some time in multiple departments, that's where the person making the decisions of the rig is on the truck, you know? And when you first get to be a part of that and experience that, career, volunteer, it doesn't matter. You quickly realize that you are empowered. This is one of the first opportunities you have in the fire service to be empowered to make decisions that are going to affect other people, other people's success or failure, you know. And I'm not talking about simply for a working fire. I'm talking about power lines down, you know, encouraging other people to do stuff, sharing experiences. I mean, there's many alarms we go to where you can take these as learning opportunities to help the new driver learn something new, or the new firefighter to learn something new. So riding the seat is your first. I mean, you make decisions as a firefighter and you make decisions as a driver. But the driver is more, and this is for another episode, but the driver is more of a systematic, you're going to take some orders, don't get me wrong, but everything about operating an apparatus is really a systematic type event. There is a lot of, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of education and knowledge that you have to utilize when you're operating a truck. But what I'm saying is that the officer's seat, or the officer on the truck, this is his first opportunity to make decisions, like I said, to help somebody grow in their career or their time as a firefighter. So it's a very important seat on the truck. If I could say which seat is the most important, I would still probably have to say the most important position on the truck is the driver, because he's got to get there safely. He's got to know where he's going. You know, he's got to know how to operate the apparatus. And at the end of the day, you never see the drivers in the paper, but they are the backbone of any type of fire ground operation. But when it comes to making decisions and the actual outcomes of an incident, the officer many times is what sets the pace and the tone for the call, you know? Whether or not you upgrade to a first alarm assignment from a still alarm, or whether or not you cancel the units prematurely or perfectly, all those things come into play when you're riding the seat, you know? And giving a good size up really sets the tone for the call. So that's it. I mean, it's not just about controlling the Q2 and hitting the air horn, because just for all of our non-first responders that are listening, like all those sirens and stuff that are operating on the truck, usually it's the officer that's manipulating that while he's looking up the map book or while he's looking at the tablet to find out where the nearest hydrant is. You know, he's also manipulating the sirens to clear traffic. There's a lot of stuff going on in that seat. And so, this individual, the company officer, and like I said, it doesn't necessarily have to be a rank. I mean, you know, in a volunteer department, somebody, a firefighter may ride this seat from time to time. But when you pull up on scene and you give that size up, you know, it's going to determine the outcome of the rest of the call. It's going to either freak people out because you're screaming on the radio. I mean, I've been there. Or it's going to set the tone like, okay, this is what we got. This is what we're going to need. And everybody's on the same page because you're giving instructions through the radio to the next incoming units. So, again, you're setting the tone for the incident. A good example is, like I said, upgrading to a first alarm assignment. You know, maybe the call comes in as a dumpster fire. Well, you arrive on scene and you realize that the dumpster, yeah, it's on fire, but it's also caught the awning of the garage on fire, and now the house is on fire. And now you're going to have a whole nother set of priorities. Maybe you need to, maybe there's extension inside the building you need to go find. Maybe there's people still inside that you need to go make sure that get out. So as the incident evolves, this individual, again, really sets the tone on how that incident is going to wrap itself up. Now, that first arriving officer usually isn't going to be the incident commander for the entire incident. Usually a higher ranking officer will arrive on scene and assume command and direct all the other companies to do their thing. But this is just a very important seat on the apparatus. You know, and then back at the station, that individual, if it is in officer rank, you're going to be responsible to make sure your crew takes care of the station maintenance, yard maintenance. Maybe you go out and test hydrants from time to time. Maybe you go out and do company inspections. One of the things I used to like to do when we'd go to like a fire alarm sounding at a residence, we really don't have any authority to do any type of fire inspection on residential properties. But if I saw that a customer had some concerns about stuff, I may take a moment to walk them through and ask them, you know, check their smoke detectors and maybe ask them if they have a fire extinguisher if handy, and or maybe they should go get one, and talk about having an exit strategy. I mean, just taking a few extra minutes, that extra customer service that you give a resident. You know, because the fire marshal's office is going to go in all the commercial buildings and they're going to talk about all this stuff with business owners, but we don't, it's been noticed over my career that we don't necessarily take the time to do that for residential occupancies. And like I said, we don't have any authority to close their residence, but what's wrong with talking to somebody and saying, hey, by the way, if you ever have grease on the stove and it catches on fire, do you know how to extinguish that? Or, hey, do you know what number to call if there's an emergency? And when you do, do you know what your address is? You know, there's kids these days that do not know their address. They rely on memory to get to their house or their phone. But there's a lot of, I mean, with my daughter, I've asked some of her friends, they don't know what their address is. So when you call 911, what are you going to tell them? I'm at my house. What's your address? Well, I don't know. And we lost a lot of that stuff, of course, with technology when we got cell phones and all that. But going through the ranks, this is the first, like I said, this is your first opportunity to be empowered. And so not only are you making decisions that are affecting your crew, and making sure they're successful on the fire ground, but you're going to make decisions that are either going to make somebody's day get a lot better or stay the same or possibly get a lot worse. And it's definitely a position on the rig not to take lightly. But there is some great opportunities. A lot of camaraderie comes from the company officer. And if the company officer is not in a good mood, usually the whole crew may not be in a good mood. And so it's important to understand the effect that you have when you're riding the seat, back in quarters as well as on the truck. And so that's been my experience on that. And so each rank, of course, sets you up for the next one. Maybe you go from being an engine company officer, to riding the seat on a truck company, you know, and now on a truck company, you got a whole different set of responsibilities. Maybe you are responsible. Maybe you don't go to as many runs as you did when you were on the engine. Right? Maybe you have more technical requirements when you arrive on the scene. You know, many times, for those of you that are not firefighters, many times we kind of already have when we respond to an alarm, we kind of already know what our role is in that alarm. I mean, if we're the fifth truck arriving on scene, if that's what's needed, right, we're not going to be catching the fire hydrant. You know, I would hope that by the time the fifth apparatus gets there and there's a whole street lined with trucks, that that fifth truck isn't the one hitting the hydrant, you know. But the guy coming in second knows he needs to get the hydrant, you know. So a lot of this stuff is somewhat pre-planned, but you change it up and the first arriving officer realizes he steps out of the truck and somebody says, hey, my mom is still inside. The whole parameters change. You know, that company officer is going to give directions to the next due engine to just probably get a line down and help with the rescue. You know, so we have a baseline to start with when we arrive on scene, but that doesn't necessarily mean it won't escalate. And so when it comes back to size up, talking about sizing up. So you're responding, dispatch is telling you, you know, I'm a brand new, well, let me give you an example. When I was in Missouri, and if my buddy's listening, he'll laugh about this, but I rode the rescue truck to a car wreck. We were having a training night, and I got to ride the seat on the rescue truck right down the street from the station. Somebody came in and reported a vehicle accident. And so I rode the seat down there, and I gave a size up. We were on scene. We had one vehicle rolled over on its top, and we were going to begin extrication. And so remember, I think I'm barely a full-fledged volunteer firefighter. I hadn't really had any experience. But when I got back, it was noted that apparently I was kind of screaming on the radio, you know. So let me give you that example. Your new officer tones out for a possible structure fire in your district. You know where you're going. You got that figured out. You've got a seasoned driver, let's say. He knows where he's going. Of course, he's testing you too, right? He wants to see how you're going to behave. But, you know, you arrive on scene and you're like, hey, we got a working fire. I get that. The first time you ever do it, you're just going to be like, we got a working fire. I got fire everywhere or whatever. We got smoke showing. As you grow and develop through the rank, that particular rank, you'll get more seasoned with it and more in tune with stuff. And the goal is to kind of paint a picture within, you know, a couple seconds, like 10, 20, 25 seconds, do a size up. Hey, I'm on scene. I got a single story residential structure. It appears that everybody's out of the house. I got smoke pumping out of the eaves. Second truck in, lay a supply line, and we're going to be dropping a hand line for fire attack and search and rescue. Because even though we know that everybody's out of the house, usually we're still going to do search and rescue to make sure everybody's out. But that is a baseline size up. And then, of course, there's the whole, hey, I'm on scene. I've got a large commercial building. I got fire through the roof. Multiple exposures, make it a second alarm, you know. All that stuff kind of comes with time. But what I used to tell guys when we were coming up through the ranks and sharing with drivers I would get or firefighters is, you know, I think I've mentioned this in other episodes. When you're driving around the city, you've got these buildings. And I don't know if you're like me, but you may look at a building and be like, I wonder when that thing's going to burn. It's been vacant for a long time. You can use those opportunities on or off duty to think about, okay, if that thing's on fire, what am I going to say? And in my city, we've always done size ups for even a silent alarm. I mean, even if it's just we're on scene, we got nothing visible, we're out investigating, we're establishing command, you know, and that's what happens with that is when you practice that on every call, no matter what it is, it sets you up to be successful in the bigger calls because a lot of that stuff's going to come naturally. Because you do need to give your scene an identity. You do need to say I'm command on North 10th because if engine 18 is working a call on South 10th, you need to be dispatch needs to be able to distinguish it between the two. So you may not want to call it 10th command. You'd call it North 10th command, or engine 18 would call their South 10th command, or J.C. Penney command or whatever. And so there's a whole science behind doing a size up. So if you're from the general public and you've seen some of this stuff orchestrated on your neighborhood street, it looks like a fire drill. It looks like it may look like it may look like chaos. But in reality, your neighborhood companies are arriving. They know what they're doing. And to watch it orchestrate, really, to watch it orchestrate. I mean, yes, there's times when the fire is going to be growing while you have a bunch of firefighters on the scene. And it's maybe because, you know, why aren't they putting the fire out? Well, you know, maybe something's going on in the back that we don't know about. Or maybe they, you know, the gate was locked and it's a super, super duper locked gate that they can't get through. I mean, it's definitely not for lack of trying. But what I'm saying is to watch everything unfold the way it should be, like the Billiken theory, the way things ought to be. It's truly amazing to watch stuff unfold. It's amazing to watch your city's resources or your community's resources to arrive for these individuals, volunteer career to get off that rig and be ready to go do what they need to do. And then just to watch it all fold. I mean, all the way from start to finish, you know, from rolling up the hose at the end and picking up the water bottles they left from rehab and like just really watching it unfold. I hope if you ever happen to see something like this, I hope you appreciate the training, the commitment from everybody, the municipality, the community, the ESD, and what goes through really making a fire department work. Because, like I said, when you watch it unfold on the scene, it truly is amazing. Take care, everybody. We'll talk to you soon. We'll have new episodes coming out soon. I know it's tough. It's been a month, but I got one in February. I'm glad to have done that. Take care of yourselves. Reach out to us at justifiablyproud@gmail.com if you have any questions, and we'll see you on the flip side. Bye-bye.